What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Vintage and Stuff with your boy, Drew Heifetz. Today, I have Anthony, a.k.a. I Got Polo, on the show. And trust me, we get into why his name is I Got Polo. It's actually a really crazy story. I was not aware of how deep that story goes. So you definitely want to watch till the end to hear the story about Polo. But a big part of this episode is talking about bandos again. I know we talk about bandos on this show a lot, aka abandoned buildings, houses, picking in abandoned places. But Anthony, unbeknownst to most of you, is actually the godfather of the whole picking in bando movements. And again, that story that he tells is crazy, of how he got into it, his respect for it, his history with it. It's pretty crazy. So glad I went there on this one with him. And yes, I know we talk about bandos a lot, but it's super interesting stuff. We also talk about a lot of other things. He rolls deep. He's been doing Rose Bowl for a long time. He's a San Diego local. He's mentored a lot of people. He's really out there to help big up the community. It's crazy. And he has super interesting views on the world, on fashion, on collecting, on like creating experiences through what he does. Really interesting guy. And I know you guys are going to love this episode. So I won't keep you anymore here. Just get fired up. It's a good one. Anthony, I Got Polo. Welcome to the show, my man.
Yes, yes. I'm very happy to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So I've known you for quite some time, mostly through Rose Bowl encounters and, you know, getting to see you here and there in the vintage community. And, you know, I've sort of seen you roll with a thick crew for a long time. That's something I know about you. You're always like rolling with a thick crew.
Yeah, it's like playing in the band, you know?
Playing in the band.
It's like I like to have other people be able to fill positions and kind of play in the band like that with me, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. I've never heard of it put like that. And that makes sense because you're also a bit of a deadhead, right? And you follow, you tour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've been in the Dead for a long time. It was just kind of a resurgence for me. Like, you know, I get into a lot of things. I head into a lot of directions, so it's hard to be everything, right? So I always got to go back and retread ground, but I always keep a piece of everything with me as I go, too. So okay, it's one of those things to where a lot of people didn't even know I was a Deadhead, you know, even though it's like I'm from freaking like Deadhead town, and it's like there's no way I would have not been immersed in it. Just because it's like, oh, you're also a skateboarder and you like dancehall reggae, and you know, it's like, well, that's how deadheads are, you know. It's like when you're ahead, you're ahead.
Yeah, I want to talk a lot more about that. I want to talk about your experiences, yeah, touring and how that all goes for you. I want to talk about how you got in the vintage game. I want to talk about Rose Bowl and your crew more. I want to talk about Festivus. There's lots we're going to cover on this episode, but I also, something that I think people will really be interested in is, I kind of think of you as the godfather of starting the bando movement. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people know this. I think a lot of people look at, say, Kyle maybe, or some of these other younger kids, but they were sort of mentored by you, from what I understand. And that, obviously, we see that movement is like going crazy right now. all over the US. And I want to know sort of your take on it, how you first got into it, like some of those first experiences and like, I guess how you started to mentor some of these younger kids in the game.
So I was always kind of in those places. A lot of my vintage and my sourcing has to do like kind of with just very personal experiences, you know. I'd almost say this kind of like not just good ones too, but bad ones, just kind of like bummer trips that I had in the back, you know, in my life. And then you want to kind of take power over those, you know?
So what do you mean by bummer trips? First of all, too, some people keep asking this on these episodes. When I say bando, we're talking about abandoned buildings.
Yeah.
So what do you mean bummer trips? Explain that.
Well, bandos are like sources of bummer trips. If you think about it, they're abandoned. So it's like their welcoming energy went away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like it was a welcoming place with like a happy home, you know, like an energy that gathered people. And it does it again now. You understand? Like before it was a scary place. People are like, it's haunted, you know, and then these are like, you know, forlorn places. And then kind of like turning it on its head is what it was. Because it's like I was in all of these places a long time ago. And I recognized then when they were still like real, real forlorn, I was like, no, this is actually like, you know, a place that you could find something. But that's mainly because I was looking for that there, because all I was finding was kind of like bummers, you know, like the first bandos that I ever went into, you know, they were kind of bummers basically. You know what I mean? It was
and
like,
when you say you were there before, do you mean like do you mean like you partied at some of these places previously?
No, or? So I frequently, you know, the first time I ever went into one was my own family's, you see, because I come from a family that came from San Diego, was there like forever. And so they had a family generational home, and it was one of the first ones built, and it was a ranch in the mid-century, you know, before it's like my grandfather was in the Navy. And okay. So I went into the backyard and found all of the stuff back there. And then that's how I figured out that all of the houses got built up around it. And that my dad was like, yeah, we were the only house on top of this hill. And this was a ranch when I was a kid. And he was like one of the first surfers on the West Coast. It was like they were making surfboards in the wood shop on the farm. And so I'm sitting here and I'm like, wait, ranches and farming? And he was like, yeah. San Diego was like a big ranch land besides the Navy. And so I go back there and I learned all of this, but at the same time, it was a bummer because it was just totally like left, like the, like, you know, just abandoned basically. Right. And so I even find my dad's war medals back there in the dirt and learn this crazy story where like my dad came home with all of his like, you know, Vietnam stuff on to see my grandpa. And my grandpa's just like, well, what do you want? Like, you know, pat on the back, like, you know, and just goes back to drinking his beer. So I guess my dad took all his Vietnam stuff and just dumped it back there in the sheds. And so I found all that stuff when I was a kid. And to me, all that stuff getting dumped was like a bummer because I valued it, you know, and then the fact that everything was just back there. And so all throughout, like we lost that like place, you know. And so all throughout my teens, I would be out in different places like the desert and stuff. And I would go into other people's kind of things and I'd see what happened to their stuff like the same way where it's like, you know, I understood that you could have all these things that you valued in your life, but then move on and that someone else would value it greatly, but it would just be left there. And so I would go there and there was no value in taking any of this stuff. There was nowhere to sell it. I was just a teen. And so I did go there and just like, you know, dick around and all that stuff was all there. You know what I mean? Forever and ever. And I always knew it was there, you know, just everything.
That's so crazy. And so your family's place, you went there probably like around the time they were like getting rid of the property or something.
Yeah, this is in the 90s. So it was before my grandma died. You know, my grandpa was still alive. So I had to watch him die of emphysema. And then my grandma was around. And then when the grandma passed, my family, like it's like there's like a brother and a sister and another brother. So it's like there's one house, right? And so they squander the property. And my grandfather was like a master cabinet builder that owned a cabinet shop in town. So he had the cabinet shop shirts with his name on it that were chain stitched. And he was a decorated, like two silver stars, one bronze star, like saved a ship from sinking in Pearl Harbor. And he had like so much of the, like if I would have been able to keep all my family stuff, just my family stuff would have been a vintage load in itself. Just from what I remember as a kid, the truck on the RRL sweater, my grandpa had that truck. Let's put it that way. Wow. You know what I mean? So I had to watch all that stuff just get thrown to the wind. And it hurt my dad too, because he wanted to keep it. He was the only one that apprenticed. Like the other brother didn't apprentice under my grandpa as a cabinet builder. And my dad went through all the trouble to do that. But then parents and people from the old days were like real assholes, you know, like put you through Catholic school and they're real hard and tough. And so my grandpa was just like super tough and never like let my dad get ever anything, you know what I mean? Like ever like a hug or nothing until like the very end when it was like dying of emphysema. And then finally he started loosening up. But then after that, it's bittersweet because it's like he doesn't get to keep the truck, the cabinet workshop or any of that. And so from that, we split to Idaho. And then.
Oh, you and your family moved to Idaho.
Yeah. And so even there, immediately after we lose the family home, we go to Idaho and I start going into like bandos there. And then like one of them ends up being a sawmill that my dad worked at as a logger in the 60s. So the story is I wore Carhartt pants to school because my parents were poor and I got made fun of it, but I thought it was cool anyway. Right. And then I go out into a sawmill. And I find Carhartts and like tools and stuff. And so I start taking it and I take some like overalls or something like that. And I go back to my dad and I'm like, yeah, like I found Carhartt and there's some tools. We should go back there and take it. We could like pawn them and like you can get beer money and like you can get some toys. Right. Like I'm sitting here and I'm already like, you know, thinking like this. Right.
Scheming.
My dad is just like super, like he is so burnt at me. He is like, first of all, he's like, those are my tools I left back in there. And I was counting on no one ever taking them. He's like, it's like stealing from your ancestors. He's like, I worked in that mill. He's like, guess whose shit you're taking? He's like, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting there and I'm just like, you know, and also I'm thinking it's going to be cool, you know, cause my dad also will come around, you know, usually.
Yeah.
And then this time he didn't. It was like, I set something off in him for like months after that, you know, he would just be like, you fucking, you're this and that, and just like bring it up and just be like, dude, I can't believe, like, you know, you did that. And so he brought me out someplace to teach me a lesson because he'd been in Idaho, you know, as a logger in the 60s. So he brings me out to someplace in some river and just tells me to go walk along it. And then I start walking along it and then there's all these alcoves and all this stuff. And it's just basically an untouched, just like mining area. And there's all the stuff there. And I go in there and then I come back and he's like, yeah, he's like, you're supposed to leave that for later generations. Like that shit's going to be important for archaeologists and all this shit. You know what I mean? And so I was sitting there and I was like, all right, I thought I learned my lesson and stuff. And then, you know, it was just one of those things to where mulling over all that stuff over the years. And, I don't know, going back to those places, it's like, I was always searching for something, you know what I mean? And then I just considered like, you know, my dad was also hardcore, like, was it Catholic, you know? So he kind of like had this whole guilt trip about everything is what I figured out, you know? Because also I talked with him about a whole bunch of stuff later before he died. And he kind of like, you know, realized that like he was tripping on shit. So I don't think he would trip on me going into the bandos anymore. But it is one of those things I think about from time to time. And it has motivated some of my decisions in bando making, I guess. Like going out and hitting stuff.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, it is true. Like, there's a level of stripping the American back roads of all this stuff, right? That who knows if it's ever going to see the light of day, if it's going to get bulldozed or what's going to happen. But it's an interesting thought. Like your dad says, like, this is somebody's stuff. This is my tools, right?
Yeah. There was also, I mean, the mentalities these people had about the clothes. And it's like, I was a Boy Scout and you could buy the patches, right? You could just get the patches and put them on your Boy Scout shirt. But you had to earn it, type of thing, you know?
Well, that's the whole point. You're supposed to do the task, right? To get the patch, like the fire starter patch or the whatever, spend a night outside patch, right? Like, you got to earn that shit.
So even just like the uniform clothes, like, you had to earn that and have it issued to you. So like, the whole idea of like people picking up archival fashion items and stuff is like anathema to these people. Like, these things are garments of position, and for certain like ceremonial use, basically it's like work. You know what I mean? And there's sort of like a air about you when you do your work, and it means something, you know. It's like a professionalism. It's like, you know, and you don't wear that and send that message when you're not doing that. You immediately switch into a whole another thing. You know what I mean? And then the air about you changes, you know?
Yeah. That's an interesting topic as well, because nowadays that doesn't exist as much in our society, right? You have, it's kind of like dressing to your class or dressing to your job or whatever it is you do, but we don't do that anymore, really. Sure, people on Wall Street wear suits, but you also have super rich businessmen that wear ripped up Nirvana t-shirts, right? Or freaking Carhartts or whatever. And now that whole thing has changed. So we've like turned that uniform mentality into fashion. And I guess that's why vintage is cool in the first place.
The tech wear thing can get very uniform if you think about it, where it's just, they're trying to be minimalistic, you know, but like, then everybody will have like very ubiquitous pieces, you know. It kind of evolved, right? Yeah. I think probably even from now, Japan.
Like, you're like, these people are out there dressing like they're going to go on a hike in the mountains, and then they never do.
Yeah, that's the Gorp core or whatever.
They
want to
portray that, right? Yeah, they want to portray this vibe that they're healthy and in nature.
It's called yuppie, is what they used to call it, right? This idea that you would be a weekend warrior, okay? And so that was a bad connotation. And so they had to take that and flip that and be like, oh, yeah, like, no, I'm an outdoor enthusiast because I have a great job. You know, because back in the day in the 90s, mountain climber dudes were considered like yuppies. You know what I mean? And then guys that surfed.
But the real dirtbag mountain climbers, like people in Yosemite, they were probably the ones coining the term yuppie.
Yeah.
At the other people who came on the weekends.
Because there was also the surfers who lived on the beach in a van. And they don't like the guys who only come out on the weekend. They call them kooks because they can't surf very good. And then they got like, you know, pink surf wax or, you know, whatever the latest freaking surf thing's selling, right? And these guys are like, look at this fucking kook. You know what I mean? Get back to your fucking really rich guy job, man. I'm sitting here drinking beers, living in a van. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a term for every subculture, for sure.
Right. And so Howley, what's funny is, Hawaii. Like, everybody likes the yuppie guy's shirts, but the dude in the van, you know, his shirts are always better, but you can't get those shirts. You know, the guy wore them and ripped them up and threw them in the trash. That's why you want his shirts. You know what I mean? The yuppie guy's shirts are like all in everybody's garage, and it's like some fucking surf wear thing, all fucking, you know, neon. He didn't go to a real surf shop, you know?
Yeah, totally. And that's the same with like most subcultures. Like that's why skate shit's hard to find, because the kids wore it, they ripped it up, and it was trash at the end. It's hard to find OG skate shit. Or
yeah. I want to
keep on this topic. Go ahead.
And I personally had all of that stuff too when it came out, and I was going backwards and buying the stuff at yard sales and had all the old Caballeros and fucking stuff. But being a skateboarder too means the life back then, you didn't get to like keep all your stuff or like keep a pad. So it's like I would just like constantly lose my pad and just lose all my stuff that I would hoard. So that's another reason why I do this, is because like now I got stability and I keep my stuff. So I do the same thing. I just rapidly always have to get stuff because I would lose pads. And now I don't lose pads, and I just still rapidly get shit, and it just like, oh shit, adds up, you know?
Hell yeah, it does. Quick intermission from the episode. I want to tell you, if you're enjoying what you're hearing, if you're liking listening to us ramble on about vintage and the world, then you really should join the Patreon, guys. And I know a lot of you guys have been procrastinating joining the Patreon. You know why I know you're procrastinating joining? Because you guys tell me. I get DMs all the time. Oh, I meant to join. Patreon has a very user-friendly app now, so you can get it on your phone. You can tap into the episodes there. You get a free 7-day trial, so it really costs you nothing. And then after that, it's just $5 a month, which is $1.25 an episode. Now, stop procrastinating things in your life. You know, I'm going to use the make your bed philosophy. Get up in the morning, make your bed. At least you know when you come home at the end of the day, you've made your bed. Stop procrastinating the little things in your life, the little things like signing up for the Patreon to get the full 2-hour episodes, which is going to educate you so much about the business. All the really good deep stuff are in the 2-hour episodes. It's going to make you more money. It's going to make you a lot more money, a lot more than $5 extra a month. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to thank me later. Stop procrastinating. Go right now and get on the Patreon. Enough said. Back to the episode. Tell us about moving back to SD from Idaho, and then like how you started to pick up hitting these spots again. Because I know a lot of the spots that you originally were hitting were like trailer parks, right? Like
yeah,
pretty down and out. And that's probably what you're referring to a lot of these bad trips too, because those places were like drug dens, potentially like meth labs or whatever the fuck they were. I don't know. You tell us, but seem like they're pretty wild places.
So actually I've always been into toys, right? And so we get back from San Diego, and one of my best friends, his dad makes a whole living going out into the desert. But back then, these places aren't quite abandoned yet. Like they're abandoned, but like this guy's old and has some sort of way to know. He has a person named Billy who lives in the desert, and he has a way to know all the veterans because the veterans know each other. And so his deal is we go out into the desert and he buys full complete footlockers, like World War II footlockers with everything folded in there, and even the freaking handgun, the watch, the whole thing. And he'd buy like 3 to 5 of them.
Okay, yeah. So footlocker, for people that don't know, is like, it's like a trunk that people would keep their whole kit in, right? Like everything they have, like when they went home after the war.
And so he would buy complete footlockers, which now would go and auction for like 10, 20 grand. Right. And he had like a buyer lined up, you know, where he'd get like fucking $2,000, $5,000, depending on what was in there. So my buddy would go on trips out to the desert with him sometimes because he was forced, but he would bitch about it. But then I heard about it because he was like saying like, yeah, there's like all these abandoned places over there and it's full of stuff. And then I asked him and I'm like, dude, you ever see any toys? And he's like, yeah, one time I did see some G.I. Joes. And I sat there and that's all I needed to hear, was that there was an abandoned house with G.I. Joes out there. And I'm like, dude, we're going out there. We got to go look for G.I. Joes and old toys in these abandoned houses in the desert that someone left in the 80s. And so sure as shit, we go out there and we find a bunch of scorpions and shit at first. And we're looking around. And then, yeah, we end up finding like a fucking decrepit toy room and fucking just stripping it, you know, and bringing it all back and playing with it. You know, so no, it actually worked out. And that's what taught me that you could kind of dream that the shit would be there that you're looking for, and it would just be there. Right. And even to this day, I found toy rooms like that where there's still toy rooms. That's another thing, is like, I, Not even for jeans. I look for old, decrepit toy rooms.
And at this age, you're still at the age where you're playing with G.I. Joe. Like, how old were you at this time?
I never gave it up. I took it as a characteristic because in those days, there was an actual like demarcation line. Okay. It's time to give your toys up. Right. And so I got bounced around a lot in my family, right? I lived with aunts and stuff like that. So they never found a way to like, all right, because they would try to bounce me around and be like, all right, you're not going to get toys anymore. And so what I would do is when the other kids had that happen to them, I would just sit there and be like, yeah, toys ain't cool no more. But this one's like, you know, this and that. And I would be like I'd have Pogs or some shit that they gave me, you know. And like one kid, like I was like, dude, yeah, Pogs are hitting. Like, you know, and then you'd go to school and everybody wanted to play Pogs and I hated them shits. They were just cardboard discs. I traded all my Pogs and I got like 180 G.I. Joes and the fucking massive fortress. And this kid hated those because his mom bought them all at a yard sale for him because she wouldn't buy him new toys. And he was like, yeah. He's like, I got G.I. Joes. My mom got them all at a yard sale. Like, and this and that. And so I'm sitting here and I'm like, yeah. I got Pogs. I hate these. I'm like, here, you take my Pogs, I take your fucking toys. And so throughout all the teens too, everybody would just be getting older. And then I would just be sitting there like trading them weed or something and being like, yeah, I got tons of weed. I was like, what kind of shit you got around? I'm like, let me get your shoebox with all your figures and shit. And so I'd go back to my buddy's house to also play toys. And we would just sit there and hang out and play video games in his game room. And just have like fucking toys, just play with them, fucking, you know. And we did magic cards and all the shit when it came out, like the whole Pokemon shit, you know, like fucking just kept up with it because, you know, like out of stubbornness where I was like, no, I'm going to be cool and I'm going to be hip and tough and I'm still going to fuck with toys. Like, you know, I was like, if I just fucking stick with my shit. And so even like 1998 or something, 1999 came around. For my birthday, I still asked for G.I. Joes, and they just came out with them in Toys R Us. And everyone thought it was a real trip at my birthday, where like everyone else wanted skateboard shit. And I'm like still opening up G.I. Joe toys. And I'm like, yeah. I was like, I don't need a new skate. I already got a new skate. And I had like three Shorties backpacks. I had the Osiris G bag. Like, you know, I had all the shit, you know, so I didn't need any of that shit. I just wanted my toys back because something established in me when I lost them the first time that I could never not have them. And so even to this day, it's like there's some sort of trigger that got put there. Or they do something with the cartoon. I don't know. The cartoon might have some sort of way to mysteriously fucking program you because everybody I know that does G.I. Joe too, they're mysteriously programmed. It's like, gotta have those. And I've been to people who have entire rooms where you walk in and it's just from floor to ceiling, 360, just completely dedicated to these figures. And I was like, dude, these fucking things hypnotize you.
Subliminal messaging, man. All the biggest toy franchises have TV shows. Fucking
yeah.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, He-Man, My Little Pony, all of them have TV shows because they program everybody to just want the toys, right?
So they had it timed where you woke up and you're just first waking up. And then they had some sort of cereal that matched the shit too with like marshmallows that was heavily sugar. So you're getting like this crazy like rush of like, boom, there's the matching. Like, cause it's like you'd have the G.I. Joe cereal with the G.I. Joe. I had all this shit in the 80s. It was like my parents did that to me, right? Where I'd get the Nintendo cereal and I'd get the new Nintendo game and I'd fucking play. I played Zelda and ate the Zelda cereal.
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that, but they really had it on lockdown. They had us like, they're hitting us from all angles with this shit, right?
Sophisticated marketing techniques, right? And then they give us these totems of power. Because that's the other thing is like parroting changed, you know? And then so all of a sudden, like, you know, you're kind of getting some power from some sort of little character figure, you know, to get comfort. It's like, I used to want to drag them to school and the school hates that. They don't want you fucking sitting there, like not paying attention to their work and just dicking around with figures, you know, but they'd make you feel comfortable. And then so you carry that into adulthood is what I figured out is a whole lot of people who I was dealing in the toys, they didn't go through a whole like really cool phase where they were cool in high school. A lot of them, you know, were kind of like less hit people, you know. And then I would get into G.I. Joes and I would make them feel cooler because they're like, oh, here's a cool guy. And he's selling me G.I. Joes and maybe being grown up and having G.I. Joes is actually cool. And so I watched also toys like just go from being like super, you know, kind of lame thing to like now it's just everybody's into toys and it's super cool. And being a nerd is cool. You know what I mean?
It was, so do it you still like you, made fun you of. Still fuck with toys today and you still have big stashes or what?
Every single day I fuck with toys, as a matter of fact. Yeah. It's like nice. I got friends who are just toy friends. And what's funny is like I had friends that I met through toys that I turned on to polo. Like I had a friend that I was like a huge G.I. Joe friend. And it turns out his other best friend, because I'm like his best friend, his other best friend is a DJ from New York, son. And this motherfucker has more polo than fucking, he's got like seven fucking stadiums. Like he was buying it the whole time. Like how I was doing G.I. Joe. He did that with polo and was going on like German fucking eBay. And he's not even someone who shows it. He don't got no Instagram or nothing. And this motherfucker, his wife is like a doctor too. Like, so it's like his wife is papered up. He's a DJ. He's just been buying low the whole time. And his collection is silly. It's silly.
Yeah.
Silly,
and your friend didn't even know anything about this prior?
No, he knew, but he didn't even make the connection till one day. He's like, wait, fucking son. He's like, polo. He's like, you've been fucking with polo and telling me polo the whole time. He's like, you know, my homie is this and that. And he's like, fucking, you know what I mean? And what's funny is I met his homie too, like three times, and he was wearing Tommy Hilfiger. Like he hides that he's got all the polo and he has like a Tommy Hilfiger sailing long bill on, you know, and like just real low key, like Nike, like just brand new clean tech, clean airs. Like, you know, he wears like a certain uniform. It's like real clean and low key. And he just keeps just polo. Just like, it's just like some sort of thing. There's like, it's the same thing with G.I. Joe with certain people where it's just like, you just got to have it. And it just has to be there. Like, motherfuckers don't even necessarily wear it. It's like, I don't even know.
No,
it's like,
most collectors don't wear their stuff. It's just the comfort of having it. Like, I have these bins I'm looking at right now off to my left, full of gear. Every like year I'll bring them down and look through them maybe, but that's it. I don't wear it all. There's way too much stuff, you know? And I always wonder, like, why am I keeping all this shit? Just because it has like some meaning to me, right?
It can be very That's impractical. Just how it is. It can be very impractical being a clothing collector. And see, I pride myself on being like a practical person. So I go in waves, you know, where I'm sitting here. That's why I hide shit from myself. Because then sometimes I'm like, being practical is impractical when you're letting certain shit go. You know, you're trying to sit there and be like, well, what the fuck is this thing doing for me? But at the same time, it's like, you know what I mean? Shit changes all of a sudden where it's like that stupid thing that ain't doing nothing for you. It's like, dude, 2 years later, fuck. You know what I mean? If you would have just not been so damn practical, it would have been very practical to actually jam that thing in a fucking corner. So I got so much shit hidden from myself, jammed in corners where I'm like, yeah, great. I know, motherfucker, I can sell that. It's not hard to sell that damn thing. Great. I know that, you know how many people ask me about that shit a week and I'm sitting here and I'm just like, oh, yeah, cool.
So what do you got stashed away? What are those things that you're putting away in corners?
Just first of all, polo, because it's like I got polo. So it's like what happened was everybody just wants to clean me out with polo. It got to be a thing. Or it's
so
just like,
let's rewind.
Like this guy's got polo. So show me all the polo. I want to come through and buy your polo. Right. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, dude, how many waves of fucking waves of polo buyers can I fucking survive? So I was like, I had to put some shit off limits and just make it so no one can even just fucking see it, because it's like it'll just disappear.
Yeah, it's disappointing for someone to see something and not be able to buy it, trust me. So you are I Got Polo. This is interesting because I've known you, that's been your Instagram handle since day one, right? And you know, I knew you, in my opinion, polo, well, not my opinion, but you can tell me what you think, the polo's been on some crazy waves, right? For like in the beginning of our time at Rose Bowl, it was like we were always buying it there. You can still find a lot of it at the Rose Bowl, like say 2004 to like 2010. But even up to like 2015, Polo still was pretty hot. Like it was pretty sought after. Prices were high. I don't remember exactly when Polo itself, Ralph Lauren, started reissuing all the designs, but it was probably like around 2015 or something. And then like, but I feel like now, like the whole new world of vintage dealers and people coming in the game, like nobody even gives a shit about Polo. At least the young people, you don't see it anymore. You don't see stuff popping up. Nobody's really talking about it like they used to. It used to be like the currency. It was like the grail currency that we would like hold on to as dealers and people into vintage. It's gone through so many ups and downs. So like what is your connection to it from the beginning?
Well, first I say is it got watered down because Polo needed to cash in on their own logos. We were all able to cash in on their old logos for a long time because they did stay really tasteful and above that for as long as they could. They put it off. And even when they did bring them back, first they tried to sell vintage even. You know what I mean? They're like, we got an original Fireball code. It's $1,200 or something. And it sold on their site.
Yeah.
And then they put the bear out. And they let it trickle out at first. And then they went crazy. You know, they're like, dude, let's just do fantasy stuff and just throw 40 bears on a shirt. Because people wanted it and the demand is there. And they're like, we can't just have people going sideways and buying Polo bear sweaters off everybody forever for $500. And so some of that stuff was a bubble too, where people shouldn't have been trying to get like $500 for like a printed on Polo bear thing that was happening.
Yeah, the reissue, you mean, like the resell of the reissue.
Right. No, just the original stuff back in the day. There was hardly any supply of all that Polo bear shit when it hit. Like, you know what I mean? Like all the old stuff happened and then it went away. And then all of a sudden everybody wanted it again. And Polo didn't pick up on that market right away. Like they were kind of like, And then so we had a long time where we could sit there and trade in Polo bear without Polo really competing with us and ask whatever we want. And some people just got greedy. And that's why Polo had to step in and be like, all right.
Yeah.
You know, and then
Polo was really good. Polo really is good at like, I mean, at least until they did that, was really good at like staying true to their and authentic to like their brand message and what they stood for. And I feel like that was a weird turning point because the quality they put out on that stuff, in my opinion, was terrible.
Right. No, it still has demand, but the problem is the shop started capturing it all. You can go get the look now. Like Polo is doing well, making their look accessible. And now if you're going to Polo in a vintage thing, you're going for some extremely niche stuff. So it's like the least accessible looks, you know, like their most like flagship looks, you know, like their Southwestern shit, their most like insane pieces. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it should have been there. It was there kind of from the beginning. And then a whole lot of stuff got let in the door just because it was like, you know, everybody's selling the shit and then the demand exploded. And then that, the look being accessible is one of the reasons why I got into it. And then also it did something with those little horses and the little color arrangements, you know. There was something that triggers your OCD where you're like sitting here and you're like, oh, I got to have all the colors or something like that, you know, because I'm a G.I. Joe collector and I'm like all this and that. So I liked Lacoste first. Like when I was growing up, I had all the Lacoste stuff when I was like little in the 80s. It's like my mom bought me Vans and Lacoste stuff. I didn't even know about Polo. And then I was listening to rap the whole time because I used to just dress in all like the Wu wear and shit like that. And they were talking about Polo, but it wasn't accessible because where I lived, there was no like store to really go buy it. I didn't know where to go buy it. But then I started finding it in the thrift and I was the only one that would like take to the kind of like collared shirts and shit. And then a few years later, it like starts getting big. Like all the Southern guys start wearing the collar shirts. And so I have like a huge wardrobe of this shit because I'm like obsessively going to thrift stores and just buying polo and putting together all these fucking looks for my own whimsical fucking tastes, right? And so I go on the internet and I'm like, polo collector, right? Da, 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 da. And I make like literally like a Craigslist post or something. And then I'm sitting here and I find out that, like, you know, oh shit, like there's people in New York like fucking fiending for this shit. And so, you know, I make like an Instagram eventually, but like already like through Craigslist, that polo, stupid polo post I made, already had people hitting me up being like, oh yeah, this is the polo I got. And then their polo is just like spell out like polo sport. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what, you're collecting this shit? Like, it made no sense to me because all that shit, I looked too close to like the Rockaware and WooWare shit you know what I mean? I was sitting there and I was like, you know, I'm not really going for the sporty look. You know what I mean? I'm going for the preppy look. But then I sat there and I was like, I had a lot of that sporty shit just because I was buying it because it said polo on it and it was dope. And it was like $3 or some shit. And then I'm sitting there and people were in New York are hitting me up and they're like, yeah, I'll give you like $75 for that shit that says polo high tech on it. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, fuck yeah. I got like 13 of those, dude. You know, because I would go to Kobe's and there would be like $1 a piece fucking clothes. And I'd be like, oh shit, I'll take all these polo shirts. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh yeah, how about 75 times 10? Motherfucker would be like, done. I'm like, $7.50 for $1 t-shirt, $1 button-ups, done deal. You know? God damn, and so all nice. These guys are stoked because immediately they're turning around and they're flipping that shit in fucking New York, right? And so the word gets around. And I'm sitting here and I'm driving around town. Like I wake up wild early and I'm literally buying trash bags of polo from everywhere I can get it. Like every thrift store has it at this point. Like literally no one wants it. I could go in there and there'd be a Polo Bear sweater for $4 on the rack. And I would fucking just go back and I would just sit there and I would literally have to like have a phone die and then like use somebody's phone and get on the phone because I'd be on phone conversations making deals for so long, selling like 20 trash bags full of clothes, sitting there like freaking having people send me mail orders and shit who don't have PayPal but are still willing to deal because they're like, yeah, my homie says you're good. All the package came through and is good. He's like, I'm going to da 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 da. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm like, damn, you know what I mean? But like the people who are contacting me too, where I'm like, I'm not fucking this money order over just because this guy's in New York. Like this guy sounds like fucking, you know what I mean? If I fuck his money order off, this dude's going to come see me about this shit, right?
Oh, yeah. Yo, you know? What year was this?
Oh, man. Like around, it was around like 2012 when I first made the Instagram, you know, because I made it, I got polo. But I didn't, I was going to make it just to start showing the polo because I was sitting there and I was dealing with all the polo heads and wearing it to where I didn't even consider it like a sales page. Like at first, it was more so just to like, I was getting so much of that stuff, right? And I realized like someday it might be relevant how much of this polo I had. Like I should probably picture some of it is what I was thinking. Because I ran through so much so fast. I was running through so many clothes because I was the exclusive. Like there's maybe like other people who are like, you know, wake up, do it once in a while. I'm like the exclusive guy who's waking up and going ever present. I'm going to every single fucking store and buying everything, like literally like down to the wire to where I'm trying to make it to another one like 5 minutes before they close. So I could rush in and have them sitting there being like ringing me out and letting me out while it's locked to get the fucking shit. You know what I'm saying? Cause that's how much there was and how lucrative it was. Cause it was literally leaving from me like the fucking same day.
Quick. And you had it all sold to these homies in New York just through connections you've made.
That's why all these fucking polo guys still follow me years later because I put fucking food into these fucking dudes' mouths, dude. Like for real. Like I got food in my mouth too. Cause I was sitting there fucking being like, what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is crazy. Because I was selling stuff time to time. Like, I found a Gucci bag for $3 and got 200 for it. And I was like, wow. But the polo was better because it was like, when I sold the Gucci bag, I had to sit there and convince the guy it was real. I got the dude literally calling me on the phone being like, are you sure it's real? You know what I mean? I'm sitting here like, fuck, dude. And when I sell the polo, it's like I'm sitting here and I'm getting like $100, $200 for a sweater. And motherfuckers know exactly what it is. You know what I mean? And like, want more. They're like, yeah, as soon as you get more, I'm sitting here and I'm like, fuck, this is great. this is great.
And who are these? These guys were just flipping it to the homies in New York? Did they have stores, or were they just like hustling?
Dude, I think some of these guys were also just like hardcore, like polo dudes. They had money. Like, because you know what I mean? These fuckers would spend $30, $40 on a plate of spaghetti, I guess. You know what I mean? So to them, like, they're used to going to the polo store and, like, jacking it, buying it or whatever. So even the prices that I was hitting them with, it was nothing. Like, they had friends, too, that would be in Cali that would sometimes come through. And that's why I started selling it in person, was because, like, I started realizing, I was like, man, people will just buy this shit and I won't have to fucking ship it and I'll get more for it if I sell it. Because it was also starting to, like, you know, get a little slower and pick it up. And it's like little kids in my town I put on are buying it from me. And like Taz Arnold's coming out. So people would come in Range Rovers and shit and have polo to trade even back then. You know what I mean? It was a trip. Like, you know, the whole
that was like, that was like the beginnings of you really being a vintage dealer.
Pretty much. Like, the vintage was around, and the way the first people in my town that did a vintage collective, if you went in there, would have went in there, like, the tastes were completely different. I think they had like Fred Perry track jackets, Adidas track jackets, those Lacoste like polos that are like mesh. It was like real like track centric heavy, kind of like sportswear heavy, like real like the funky Nike crew necks that have too many Nike logos on them, shit, you know. And then also things were priced really low. It was like basically thrift was basically like vintage and thrift were synonymous at this point, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't like a premium on it, you know. It was sort of like, you know, you got, I think people were literally getting like thrift store donations and then saying it was vintage to be able to sell it. So everyone had real low expectations. Like, I have sold.
Yeah, that's probably how it was just in San Diego.
What's up?
But it was like, that's probably just San Diego, because by that point, LA would have had a lot of good vintage stores.
Oh, exactly. Like that's what made everything crack, was I was smart enough to take everything up to LA. Like, when I found those guys and their expectations, you know, and I'm dealing with polo, I'm looking at that separately from vintage at the time. I'm looking at it as like resale designer clothes. Like, that's how it was like, you sell some secondhand Gucci and you wouldn't even look at what year it came out and call it vintage. It was just like secondhand. And then being able to call it vintage and make it premium, that's where everything got real unclear, because what the hell makes it vintage? And it's like, no, this is vintage, not this. Because like I said, you go into a vintage place, everyone's idea of vintage was real unclear. It was sort of just like secondhand clothes, basically. Like, maybe something that you, like a hip kid would pick, you know?
Yeah, and the polo at that point, if you're saying 2012, you know, some of the polos coming, some of it's like 80s, but a lot of it would be like mid 90s.
Yeah.
So I guess.
And also,
maybe
polo was trash at the time, too. If you went to the store, there was nothing that would anybody really would want to be. Because I tried while I was like sitting there and I'm like, fuck. Like, some things, the most expensive things, like very few, especially if you went to the outlet, it was really hard to try to shop and be cool with polo. And Gucci and any of these stores, honestly, like, I was into all these stores the whole time because rap, you know? And the problem was that anything that the rappers had that was from any of these cool brands was from New York, because they put out all that bomb shit in New York. And then if you went and tried to find it in a mall in your town, first of all, that shit was like sold years ago. And then it just didn't exist. You'd go into Louis Vuitton and it was like a super boring brand until Marc Jacobs came around. Like, I went, there was a Louis Vuitton store in my town, and I remember going in there trying to find cool shit because Cameron had a fucking like Louis Vuitton scarf and shit. And then so I tried to go into Louis Vuitton to look for something cool. And I remember just being like, fuck, this is like, it was like Dooney and Burke or something. It was like going in there and trying to find something cool. It was like, oh, okay. Like, I'm cool with a skateboard in my arm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and Gucci was like that too. It was like, okay, you know what I mean? Like, I want to be able to buy something here, but I mean, it's kind of grown up and boring or whatever. You know what I mean? They actually had Gucci in like TJ Maxx. The first Gucci I ever bought, I bought Gucci sunglasses that were real. I swear on everything, they were $20. And I bought them for $20 in TJ Maxx. That's where Gucci was at the time.
Wow.
They were in the gutter.
Thank you all for tapping in to this episode. I appreciate you. If you listened this far, you enjoyed it. And like I said in my little intermission there, stop procrastinating. If you want the full episode and the rest of all the other full episodes that you haven't heard yet, go tap into the Patreon. They're all there. And it is well worth it. You're going to learn a lot. And if you sell vintage, you're going to make more money, hands down. I give you my personal guarantee. Free 7-day trial on the Patreon. All you got to do is go jump on. You can listen to this one for free before you even have to pay a dime. Also, we've been putting a lot of items on fsandfrankvintage.com, like all these items behind me. Just dropped a ton of Coogee sweaters and Champion reverse weaves, lots of cozy sweatshirts for fall, lots of jackets, lots of cool stuff. So make sure you go tap in to fsandfrankvintage.com and use code VTGNSTUFF and get 30% off. Again, just get on the Patreon. Stop procrastinating. You support myself. You support my editor. And you're going to support yourself by making more money, hands down. No questions asked. You get the Drew Heifetz guarantee. So thank you guys again. See you on the next episode.